Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
So that question that I mentioned, if the jeans you wore on your 21st birthday, do they still fit? Because if they don't, it's likely the result of visceral fat accumulation. Well, Dr. Paddy Barrett is preventative cardiologist at the Blackrock Clinic, and he's here with me in the studio, and he's encouraging you to get the jeans out of the wardrobe, the ones that you had when you were 21, and try to squeeze them on. Why, Paddy, would we want to do that to ourselves?
So I think that's it's a rather difficult exercise for anyone and everyone to do. But I think it acts as a really good proxy indicator of your waist circumference. We know that when we think about weight, we often talk about body mass index. And we know that it's a fantastic tool for understanding the health of populations. But at an individual level, it's not the best indicator. And that's why we often use waist circumference, which technically isn't your gene size. It's just above it. But it's a really good indicator to say that over the period of time, since the time that you were likely to be at your ideal weight, has your waist circumference increased to a significant degree?
Because you're not really interested in somebody's weight per se, is that right?
Correct. I think because when we think about weight, we're really asking is what is the total weight of all of your bones, of your lean mass, like your muscle, of subcutaneous fat and visceral fat? And ultimately, what we want is we want high levels of muscle mass and low levels of visceral fat. That is the optimal body composition. The opposite of that is called sarcopenia, where you have low muscle mass and high visceral fat or high fat levels, because that's where we have the highest degree of risk associated with it. And this is to do with this idea that there's two main compartments of fat. One is being subcutaneous fat and the other is visceral fat. And the risk really comes from the visceral fat.
Okay, so talk to me about those types of fat. Subcutaneous is the fat we can see under our skin.
Correct. And so that's the fat kind of on your side, the stuff that you can pinch. So everyone's very, very aware of that. Now, the reality is everyone has differing amounts of that they can store. So if you think about your fat cell being like either a tennis ball or a beach ball, and as you fill it up, so if you only have a tennis ball size there, it gets to a certain threshold, and then basically it has to put it somewhere else, and it spills over into your visceral fat. And visceral fat is the fat that is inside your abdominal cavity. It's the stuff that's in your liver, it's in your major organs, and that is where you get this engine of inflammation that drives all the health consequences of being overweight. Now, why this is important is that the subcutaneous fat, while it may go up and down, it is very biologically inert insofar as that it adds very little in terms of your risk. And we see this with patients, say, who are very significantly overweight, but maybe it's predominantly driven by a huge amount of subcutaneous fat. And we often refer to these individuals as metabolically healthy obese. So they meet the obesity criteria, but they don't have any of the metabolic consequences.
Okay, so but then you have patients who look slimmer, but are actually far more unhealthy than the people who are clearly obese.
Correct. And so this is actually probably the main takeaway point from this. I think when people fall into the overweight category, there's a very obvious physical reminder that this may be something that they need to pay attention to. But it's the individual who's actually not particularly overweight, who has excess visceral fat, but not a significant amount of subcutaneous fat. And we know this in particularly Southeast Asian populations, where they don't, become significantly overweight, but they have very small subcutaneous compartments, but all of that fat then has to go into their visceral fat, and they develop very serious metabolic consequences like coronary artery disease and diabetes at weights much lower than we would.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, isn't it? Just going back to what you said about fat cells being able to manage to contain a tennis ball amount of fat, this subcutaneous fat that you were telling us about, and then the beach ball. Why are different people capable of storing more subcutaneous fat than others?
So there's a lot of different theories as to why. Some people refer to it as what's called your personal fat threshold, or mm-hmm. there's a theory called the adipose overflow hypothesis. And the thesis is that this is something that is likely a genetic set point that you have early in life. So you have a fixed number of cells, but those cells then have differing degrees of size. So as you gain weight, you're not gaining more of those cells. You're actually just filling them up to a greater and greater degree. And if you have the beach ball capacity, you can just keep filling them up and keep filling them up. And clearly, as you get to kind of larger size, some of it will go over into the visceral fat, but more of it will stay in the subcutaneous fat. And that is the concern here is we often refer to different body shapes and sizes, like this kind of pear shape or apple shape. And there are, say, certain females, for example, that carry more weight on their thighs, but have very, very narrow waists. And so they're likely to be metabolically healthy. Whereas someone has a large abdominal cavity, we're looking at a much more higher likelihood of visceral fat and the inflammation.
So that brings us back to where we started and your interest in the waistline and the genes fitting you, because that's telling you there's a visceral fat problem.
So that acts as a very good proxy for that. So if your genes don't fit you in the idealized sense, the likelihood of visceral fat being higher is much higher. And then we have to say, listen, well, if that's the case, what I'm interested in really is the complications that come from that or the consequences. So with higher weight, with higher visceral fat, comes all the metabolic complications that we look at in terms of higher insulin levels, higher levels of uric acid, ferritin, triglycerides, and all the other kind of blood pressure markers that really drive up the health consequences that go with that.
Mm-hmm. So how do you find out for sure, beyond the jeans that you were wearing when you were 21, whether they fit you or not, how do you find out whether you have a problem with visceral fat?
So you have to look at two ways. One, you can either do it directly or indirectly. The direct ways are basically start with your waist circumference, and that is the measure, the circumference around your abdominal cavity at the level of your belly button. So it's not your jean size. It's actually probably larger than that, and you need a tape measure for that. It's probably the simplest kind of way to do that. For females, greater than 35 inches. For males, greater than 40 inches. If you want to become more sophisticated about it, you can do specialized imaging. A DEXA scan is actually able to give an estimate of this with certain software added on. It's best to ask that question before you get the DEXA scan, because not all of them have it. And then you can go to levels like getting CT scans and MRIs. But really, for most people, a simple tape measure is going to be enough. Mm-hmm. The next question is are the consequences of that visceral fat a problem? And that's where the blood tests, etc. come in.
What are you looking for then when you see that the waist size is not where it should be, and then you go down the route of the scans and the blood tests? What are you searching for?
So in the scans, you're looking for a greater concentration of weight in that abdominal cavity area. The actual breakdowns on DEXA scans will give you an estimation of that. There's different ratios we can actually use, but the best measure is if the company actually doing the DEXA scan has a specific what's called VAT mass analysis, and that's the amount of visceral adipose tissue. Mm-hmm. And so we can benchmark that against kind of your age and sex. So we know where that should be on a distribution for age and sex match peers. So that's obviously a very technical way to do it, and requires a scan, some small amount of radiation exposure, and some technical knowledge in terms of your provider to be able to do that. But again, for most people, a simple, tape measure is going to be enough.
So now we all know how difficult it can be to shed the pounds that you can see. You're going to explain to us how to shed the pounds that maybe we can't see, the visceral fat.
And again, it all comes back to this idea of reversing insulin resistance and becoming more insulin sensitive. It is always going to be a multi-layered approach in terms of the lifestyle factors that we think about first, layered onto the potential consideration of medications and then potentially surgical options. But the first initial layer will always be starting with the four pillars of sleep, exercise, nutrition, and stress. Number one, are you getting 8 hours of sleep a night, or kind of at least close to that? Because if you're not getting that sleep properly under your belt, the likelihood of you making decisions correctly for your exercise and nutrition are decreased. Then it's basically, have you your nutrition dialed in? Have you exercise dialed in terms of an amount of aerobic and resistance training? So when we do resistance training, we're increasing the muscle mass. When we do aerobic training, we're improving our ability to dispose of glucose. Mm-hmm. So that they're tackling different things. On top of that, then, if someone has those dialed in and they're not getting to their weight targets, we then think about the addition of certain medications, for example, that have been recently introduced, and for some individuals, bariatric surgery.
Okay. What are the medications that have been recently introduced that you would use?
So I think everyone has heard of these in some way or another. The group of medications called GLP-1 agonists,
semaglutide,
Ozempic, various different categories. And these are life-changing tools for patients who are looking to lose weight and have really put in the base work in terms of weight reduction. We've seen spectacular results in terms of weight reduction, in terms of about 15% to 20% of body weight lost. But we know with that, that, and with all weight loss, comes reductions in muscle mass as well. So it's really important that if a patient is to go on those medications, which are really important tools for patients, that we are very careful about maintaining their protein intake, maintaining an aerobic and also a resistance training program to maintain their muscle mass. So we minimize the amount of muscle mass loss and maximize the amount of actual fat mass lost.
You'd be busy now if you were following all of these instructions, but I know you live what you preach. I mean, I see on your Twitter feed that you make an appointment to do your exercise. You're ticking your boxes, but you're making sure that it's in the diary and there's no escape.
Yeah, and so I say this to myself, as most anyone else. It was like, your physiology doesn't care about your schedule. It doesn't care if you're busy. And that's really difficult. I struggle with that myself. You know, in terms of I have been 20 kilograms heavier than I was. I have one of the significant genes for obesity. I have to work really hard to actually maintain my health regimen. But you just have to make that difference. But you also have to use the tools that are available to you. Mm-hmm. So in terms of that is, you know, if you're hitting all those targets, do you need those additional tools? Those medications we refer to as the GLP-1 agonists in terms of semaglutide, they're really important tools as an adjuvant to that.
Is your body always fighting to get back up to where it was, back up to the where you are now plus 20 kilograms?
Not anymore. And so
how did you change the set point? That's the question we all have.
So I think if I could, and that's persistence in terms of, but this is the interesting thing for me is that I don't fit into my jeans from my 21st. They're too big.
Right.
And so it's taken years of persistent effort to do that. But it's not easy.
Do you believe that you have changed your weight set point? Because we're told that's very difficult to do.
It is very difficult to do. But, you know, in terms of, I think when I look back when I was 21, I was doing no exercise. I had a terrible diet and I really didn't pay any attention to this. I thought I was bulletproof. I thought I was healthy and I really wasn't. And it's only when I actually put a magnifying glass on my own health metrics that I saw that I wasn't performing and that I needed to change.
Okay, questions coming in. Does dieting help your visceral fat levels or does it only help with your subcutaneous fat levels?
I suppose the unfortunate reality is that it affects both. So when people talk about, you know, do this particular exercise or do this particular diet to lose belly fat, in terms of you hear this phrase all the time, there's nothing that's going to target one really over the other. You're going to lose them in proportionate amounts.
Mary would like to know, or Brian rather would like to know about the scales that give the biometric data. You know, they'll tell you what your muscle mass is, what your bone mass is and so on. Are they a good guide? Do they work?
This is where you get into the difference between accuracy and precision. I think the trend for those are relatively okay, but the accuracy in terms of telling you where you are poor. So I think they're a good surrogate marker for changes over time, but I'm not a big fan of their accuracy.
Okay, so you get a guide. Would you be guided by them?
So I think if you see improvements or disimprovements, that's where you want to see. To be perfectly frank, the thing that is going to be one of the best indicators is take a picture of yourself and compare that over time. We all know when our body composition changes, when we've lost weight and added muscle. And that is, you know, in terms of that's a very obvious visceral, it's a very obvious kind of appearance change. And so it's physically how you look, but those changes are small. So you really do have to take a picture of yourself. It sounds kind of like vanity, but it's important comparison.
You'll see it in a picture. Alcohol then, how much of a role does alcohol play in the visceral fat story?
So when we talk about visceral fat, one of the key issues is that you get excess fat accumulation in the liver. Historically, we would refer this to alcoholic fatty liver disease, whereas now alcohol does play a role, but it's actually playing much less of a role. And we talk about non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So it is an important contributor. Alcohol is a fermented sugar when you look at it. And so it does actually. So, but if you have someone who has non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and you add alcohol into the mix, you're multiplying the effect.
You don't touch it at all, I see, from your Twitter feed.
Well, so I drink way, way, way less than I used to. I still drink alcohol, but way, way less than I used to.